call River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Call River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! You all had a lovely Valentine's Day weekend, for those of you who celebrate such things. It's the 17th day of February, 2014. A new week of Conversation Radio begins here on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the story rotator, things that capture my fancy and intrigue the intellect of a few other folks. You'll also find the brand new media player there. You'll find entree into the chat room. And, of course, the PayPal button, where we do what we do to try to keep this whole thing going. And with that in mind, a couple of notes. We begin this evening with a challenge from Dr. John. Dr. John noting, I'll match the first $50 to come in any combination. It's mid-February. Winter seems like it's been going on forever. But spring will get here eventually, when we finally can go out on the front porch. Let's make sure that when that day comes, the Horn is still going strong. So thank you very much, Dr. John, for getting us started this evening. And, you know, because, you know, we try to raise $150 every evening. Many thanks to Brother Albert, who helped us out this over the weekend by filling in the deficit remaining from last week. Thanks also going out to Chris as well. Thank you, Chris, for your help. With the help that Chris provided and the subscription help from Mark, well, by golly, we will, Dr. John's challenge is met, we will meet our fundraising goal for this evening with Sturm und Drang. Yeah, I'm here. Note from Tamara. Yay, Bob's here on the holiday. Absolutely. This is of course President's Day. The mail didn't run today. Public schools weren't open, at least here in West Virginia. That kind of thing. But yeah, I'm going to be here. That's maybe Christmas and Thanksgiving? That's 4th of July, I think. Yeah. Those are the three holidays that we observe here just because. Welcome to the Horn. Moran Monday is upon us. And it was an absolute clown car of Morans over the weekend. And we kind of got to begin with, wait. Let's do this right.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know. You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers.
Oh, it used to be it would play them both at the same time. Never mind. You know, morons. Because this is Moran Monday on the Horn. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. You will not believe your ears. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will find right-wing morons of every stripe imaginable. Unbelievable, unfathomable. Idiotic right-wing morons, mean right-wing morons, hateful right-wing morons, bigoted right-wing morons, prejudiced right-wing morons, right-wing morons, Republican, teabagger, birther, deather, tenther, booger-eaters all. It's Moran Monday on the Horn. Yes, indeed, for less than 5 cents per hour of programming, you too can experience the full panoply of what it is to be a right-wing moron in America. And sometimes we even find other morons on Moran Monday. It's not necessarily always about the right-wingers. However, you can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. Head for the hills, and you'll be up to your armpits and Morans. Oh, yes, you will. Yes, you will. Great googly moogly. My heavenly daisies. I guess we do sort of have to start with the rather most obvious Moran of the lot. Or is this a multiple Moran nomination? Because we all kind of already knew that Marsha Blackburn... Oh, there's a song parody out there somewhere. Blackburn, idiot in mid-head of night. Take those frosted tips. Never mind. Yeah, Marsha Blackburn's a Moran. We've known she was goodness, a Moran, goodness, for rather a long time now. Goodness. What we never really anticipated, though, was that she, Marsha, would be called upon as the standard bearer for her party and her segment of the culture's benchmark idiocy in their denial of human-induced climate change. But she was. Oh, she absolutely was. But the thing is, rather like if Marsha Blackburn spoke in a forest and no one was listening, would she still be a Moran? The answer is yes. She can't, obviating that answer, she needs some empowerment. Somebody has to facilitate Marsha Blackburn's Moranity. Enter whosever brilliant idea this was at MSNBC's Meet the Prestitutes. At NBC's Meet the Prestitutes. David Gregory being the host thereof. Somebody, apparently when David Gregory was liquored up out of his mind or just wandering around somewhere on some sort of wild-eyed ecstasy binge or I don't know what, convinced him that it would be a fair fight to bring Bill Nye the Science Guy into a so-called debate. A debate? Really, David Gregory? A debate with Moran. No, Moran. Marsha Blackburn. A debate. You know, with pro and con and reasoned discourse based upon factual assertions and rhetorical devices going back 2,500 years, right? Yeah. Debate!
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
I don't think it means what David Gregory thinks it means, Inigo. I don't. So, to whomever had the brilliant idea of, hey, let's pretend as if Marsha Blackburn is the intellectual equal of Bill Nye, well, what can you say?
What are you people, on dope?
I know. Now, Bill Nye is a real-life educated human being. Marsha Blackburn is a political hack who has taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from the fossil fuel industry. I don't know of the fossil fuel industry ever giving Bill Nye a penny. This is called impeaching someone's credibility. But even that is flawed for this Moran Monday, the 17th day of February, 2014, because one must first have credibility in which to find the flaw. And, well, the flaw in looking for the flaw in Marsha Blackburn's credibility is rather like looking for a needle in a needle stack. Her credibility is nothing but flaws.
Goodness!
Holy Jesus. So, a double nomination here. The easy one, the slam dunk, is Marsha Blackburn. I mean, this woman really would be a moron if she was the only human left on planet Earth. There would be, I don't know, there would be a butterfly out there that was besting her in common knowledge. Yeah. Really? But I can't dial in, I can't comprehend all of that that's taken for granted. I don't comprehend. What I would like, so as to better understand the process, I would like to know what the decision-making process is whereby someone... Please, Jesus, tell me it wasn't David Gregory. Said, you know what a good idea would be? Let's pretend that Marsha Blackburn and Bill Nye the Science Guy are intellectual equals with equally valid positions, one opposed to the other. And then we'll let them yakety at each other for a while. Now, as far as I can tell, or at least to my way of understanding, this is like, I don't know, throwing the family silverware, okay, it's flatware, it's stainless steel if we're lucky, on the pavement and letting it clang around a bit while at the same time playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Or Dark Side of the Moon. Or waiting for the bus and Jesus just left Chicago. Anything that's actually music versus something that's actually noise and calling them auditory equals. It did not, I guess you could say it didn't disappoint, except for the fact that affording Marsha Blackburn anything resembling credibility is disappointing in, of, and all by its own lonesome self. I mean, that is pretty disappointing. But nonetheless, we'll just check in with the weirdness.
The scientific community, this is not really a debate about whether climate change is real. The consensus is that it is. The majority of those who believe, in fact, that it is caused by humans, there are certainly some in the scientific community who don't believe that's the case.
See, this just... 14 seconds in, and David Gregory is already in trouble. Because he's talking about science and using the word believe. Not using the word evidence. Not using the word thinks. Not using the word knows. We ought to have a law that anyone talking about science is not allowed to use the word believe. Because believing is a religion thing. It's for believing in invisible, juvenile, delinquent, bearded smiters in the sky and flying spaghetti monsters and turtles, elephants standing on the backs of turtles and turtles all the way down and creation myths that speak to our common humanity more than they do to, say, any actual scientific understanding of the world around us. But not so with David Gregory. Oh, no, by Jesus. Oh, no. We're going to do us some believing, brethren and sistren.
And we're skeptical about some of those conclusions. But nevertheless, there is still this level of consensus. My question to begin with both of you is, in this moment of this kind of extreme weather moment, is it creating new urgency to act? Bill Nye, I'll start with you.
Well, I would say, yeah. And what I've always said, we need to do...
everything all at once, and this is an opportunity for the United States to innovate, to be the world leader in new technologies. That if you could invent a better battery, a better way to store electricity, you would change the world. And if you were to do that in a way that you could manufacture and export it, you would also do very well financially. Congresswoman, is there new urgency to act? You've heard the president.
Huh? David Gregory, you're asking a question of a teabagger who has sat in a Congress that has gone just absolutely bug spray crazy for 4 years about urgency to act. The only urgency to act that these clowns have is, we're going to repeal Obamacare before it starts consuming our Bibles.
And drought-stricken California saying that these weather emergencies, in effect, are creating the conditions that government has to act.
David, I think that what it brings to mind is how we utilize the information that we have. And we
are... Huh? What, Edith? How we utilize the information that we have. Meaning just exactly what, Marsha? Meaning that we scream, die, heretic, and take the information out and bludgeon it to death with an axe handle behind the barn and bury it at midnight and pretend that we never...
I'm not hearing. There's no climate change. Carbon is good.
Oh, God, we're going to have to get through this.
Oh, no. And I think that Bill would probably agree with this. Neither he nor I are a climate scientist.
Well, we goddamn sure know you're not, Marsha. Although, as opposed to Bill, I would guess Bill Nye, while having had a scientific-based education, would probably be able to, I don't know, just cruise around in his list of contacts in his smartphone, and probably find two or three climate scientists and maybe call them up and probably say, hey, Fred, it's Bill. You know, what about that climate? You, on the other hand, Marsha Blackburn, can find snake handlers, faith healers, and fossil fuel industry grifters in yours. See, it's that credibility thing again.
He is an engineer and actor.
He's an actor? Really? Presenter? Okay. Talking head? All right. Actor? And the Oscar this year goes to Bill Nye the Science Guy for his role in pretending that climate change is really, really, honest to goodness, real. No, see, he's not an actor. Ronald Reagan was an actor, and not a very good one. You, Marsha? Well, what are you?
I am a member of Congress.
And?
And what we have to do is look at...
Ah, yes, a member of Congress. Wait a minute. I seem to think that there are... I seem to recall that there are some words of the prophet that weren't written on the subway walls or tenement halls. There are some words of the prophet applicable here. Yes, there it is. Assume you are a member of Congress. Now assume you are an ignoramus. But I repeat myself. Thank you, Mr. Clemens. Thank you very kindly. 100-plus years later, and that remains as fresh and relevant as the day. Or was it idiot? Or was it moron? I can't remember exactly, but the gist remains the same. Over 100 years on, and it remains as fresh as the day you first penned the words, Mr. Clemens.
The information that we get from climate scientists. As you said, there is not agreement around the fact of exactly what is causing this. Even the president's own science...
Well, hell, there's not scientific agreement over exactly how goddamn stupid you are, Marsha! But it is generally recognized that you could not find your ass with both hands. That doesn't mean you are any less an idiot. See how the science works?
In technology office head, Mr. Holdren says no one single weather event is due specifically to climate change. So it drives the policy to look...
This is going to be difficult.
No tequila, no Thorazine darts.
Notice how she shifts the discussion?
The debate? I mean, nobody can point to one single climate event and therefore weather.
That was not the premise.
Inviting a teabagger to a debate is like, oh, I don't know, inviting a cannibal to a vegan feast. It's pointless.
Unless you're the cannibal. See how the metaphor extends? No, that one's a simile, isn't it?
Okay, cost-benefit analysis, what we do about it, and the impact.
Wait. We got to do the cost-benefit analysis first? What cost is not worth bearing? What price is not worth paying in order to perpetuate the ability of this species, which admittedly somewhere along the way, Marcia, produced you, to continue to live upon this planet? Because I'm anthropocentric. I'm a big fan of human. I'm not quite ready to turn the planet over to the 6-foot-tall race of cockroaches and see if those extra two sets of hands, they can, well, one extra set of hands, they're going to have to stand on something, right? That one extra, see if they can do better. I'm not in love with the past, and I'm not in love with the present, but I got a big crush on the future. And yeah, it's dangerously wrapped up in hope. And even, optimism even. For the stuff that we might accomplish. You know, if certain things don't go completely sideways. But Marcia's worried about the money because that's what they taught her to do down at Starkville, Mississippi, when somebody was giving her a degree in God only knows what at Mississippi State University. For shame, for shame. But she wants to check in to see how the money's doing first.
Exactly what is causing this. Even the president's own science and technology office head, Mr. Holdren, says no one single weather event is due specifically to climate change. So it...
How did Bill... I mean, I know one person's in the studio, one person's in another studio. Nobody can see each other. But, I mean, how did Bill Nye stay in his chair?
Drives the policy to look at cost-benefit analysis, what we do about it, and the impact that U.S. policy would have in a global environment.
Well, and that's another question that I want to get to. But there is consensus, as you say, Congresswoman, there is some skepticism about the degree to which humans may cause climate change, or can you specifically say an emergency, rather a weather event can be blamed on climate change? Some disagreement about that within the U.K. Nevertheless, within the scientific community, there is consensus, Bill Nye, and you know, among the scientists themselves on both of those questions.
Well, I got to say, once again, what people are doing is introducing the idea that scientific uncertainty, in this case about cold weather events in what we call back east, is the same as uncertainty about the whole idea of climate change. And this is unscientific. It's not logical. It is a way, apparently.
Thank you, Mr. Spock. This in via Twitter from Sandra. I say Bill Nye is a moron for debating Blackburn. And it does seem rather a futile act, doesn't it? But also, if you happen to catch him Friday on Bill Maher's program, you'll note that he said that, and he said this before a number of times, it caused the Beckerhead to have a hissy. He said that It's not the adults he's worried about. It's the children. It's the child abuse that takes place inside little children's brains when we elect to teach things like creationism and climate change denial to little children who have no choice but to listen to their parents spout ignorance, toxic, perhaps terminal ignorance. So maybe that's why he shows up. Or maybe he shows up because of that statistic that rolled out, what was it, over the weekend, that, what is it, 25% of the American population, sit down, duct tape, if you haven't seen this already, really, yeah, you want the good stuff this time. Something on the order of 25% of the American people think that the sun revolves around the earth. You have no idea how difficult that was for me to say. But I said it right. 25% of the people in this country, and you know damn good and well that they're the same people who were going to church with the snake-handling preacher who got bit this weekend and went home to Jesus, and various and sundry other kindred spirits and of that ilk. 25% of the people in the United States think the sun revolves around the earth. You know, the medieval terracentric universe. The one where the sun can stand still in the sky, just like the Bible says. Because the sun is moving around the earth. So maybe that's why Bill Nye feels the sort of zealous urgency to respond to some of this silliness. Some of this ignorance. And that's what it is. It's ignorance. It's not silliness. There's nothing silly about this. This is deadly in earnest.
That the fossil fuel industry has dealt with our politics. And this is not good. Everybody, this is not...
Wait just a minute. See, this is the point where Bill Nye needs to just hammer the wooden garlic-coated stake right in through the middle of her chest. Because she has taken hundreds of thousands of dollars. Marsha has. Goodness! From the petroleum, hydro, fossil fuel, energy, poison, goop industry. Yeah, she has. I mean, were there rules before this debate? Now, Bill, you understand Congresswoman Blackburn has taken so much money from the fossil fuel industry that if we were being at all unbiased about this, we would make her appear coated in 5W20. But don't mention that, because otherwise it's not a debate anymore, and the last of her credibility is gone with everybody on the planet except those people who keep going to the polls and voting for her. But they're also the same people who think that the sun revolves around the earth. But you got the rules now, Bill?
You don't need a PhD in climate science to understand what's going on. That things that we have overwhelming evidence that climate is changing, that you cannot tie any one event to that, is not the same as doubt about the whole thing.
Well, I think that what you have to do is look at what that warming is.
What is that warming?
And when you look at the fact that we have gone from 320 parts per million...
No, really. You thought you could put down the duct tape and the tennis balls, didn't you? No, you're going to go... You're going to want another circuit around and maybe a second tennis ball. Maybe even tape a couple into your hands for banging on things so you won't hurt your fragile hand bones. Gee, Marsha, explain us what those parts per million... please.
This is not, you don't need a PhD in climate science to understand
what's
going on.
And Marsha ain't got one.
that things that we have overwhelming evidence that climate is changing, that you cannot tie any one event to that, is not the same as doubt about the whole thing.
Well, I think that what you have to do is look at what that warming is. And when you look at the fact that we have gone from 320 parts per million, 0.032 to 0.040, 400 parts per million, what you do is realize it's very slight. Now, there is not consensus, and you can look at the latest.
Your lap is really easy.
It's very slight. Those are some tiny, tiny little numbers. They're tiny enough to fit in my tiny mind. They're little bitty numbers. I mean, first I had to think about millions, and then I had to think about little tiny fractions of parts of millions, and I had to do some ciphering and some gazintas, and it's just very slight.
Marcia, come on up to West Virginia, Marcia.
It's not that long a drive. From where you live,
from D.C., it's about 6 hours, and from your district there in Tennessee, Stan, maybe seven. Come on up. Come on up. Bring somebody you love with you. We'll set you out some glasses of tap water. And we'll talk about the very, very slight differences between a part per million and a part per billion. And if your taste buds can't tell it, maybe the licorice smell will let your will show us that your nose knows the difference in those very slight numbers. Come on, tell us more about the slight, Marcia.
IPCC report, and look at Dr. Lindzen from MIT, his rejection of that, or Judith Curry, who recently, from Georgia Tech. There is not consensus there.
Well, once again, the Congresswoman is trying to introduce doubt, and doubt in the whole idea of climate change. So what I would encourage everybody to do is back up and let's agree on the facts. Would you say that the Antarctic has less ice than it used to? When you said, you asserted, Congresswoman, that a change from 320 to 400 parts per million is insignificant, my goodness, that's 30%. I mean, that's an enormous change, and it's changing the world, and that's just over the last few decades.
I got an idea. Let's put Marcia Blackburn in a room with a complete Earth oxygen-type mix atmosphere, and then let's reduce the oxygen by 30% and see how effing slight it is. Then again, she's probably not even a carbon-based life form, so it wouldn't make a damn difference. One of these days, she's going to just turn on the homing beacon and all those weird little teabaggers from Norblap 9 are going to descend to serve man, and it's a cookbook.
Go back to 1750 with the invention of the steam engine. I mean, everybody's been over this a lot, but it's gone from 250 to 400. There is no debate in the scientific community, and I can encourage the Congresswoman to really look at the facts. You are our leader. We need you to change things, not...
Okay, I think we just reinforced Sandra's nomination. Did Bill Nye really say that she is a leader? Well, yeah, I guess she leads birthers and tenthers and deathers and booger eaters. But that's like leading the clowns in the circus parade. She's not. The only thing she's leading is her weird little constituents down the primrose path to a roasted planet.
Deny what's happening.
Enough. I can't stand anymore. It went on and on and on. There's another chunk, and I just don't have it in me to play any more Marcia, Marcia, Marcia. Except to note this one. What it is she's burned out. She's bent up, bent out of shape, burned up, whatever, about carbon emissions. That's the end, because she takes so much money from the fossil fuels industry that she cares more about the quarterly profit and loss statement of ExxonMobil than she does about whether or not human beings can go on, you know, 9-year-olds get to be 10-year-olds. And at one point in time, and she's head up about the EPA, and right.
David, one of the things we have to remember is cost-benefit analysis has to take place. And it's unfortunate that some of the federal agencies are not conducting that cost-benefit analysis. They're focused on the outcome. You know, when you look at the social cost of carbon, and there's a lot of ambiguity around that, what you also need to be doing is looking at the benefits of carbon and what that has on increased agricultural production. A lot of good studies out there about that, and scientists and biologists have done that study.
Well, is it study or studies, Marcia? The benefits of carbon. It sounds like one of those grainy black and white film strips from elementary school, doesn't it? The benefits of carbon. With a picture of, you know, some white kid in the 1950s and his dad standing by the Weber gas grill. Son, would you hand me that bag of carbon charcoal briquettes?
Sure, Dad.
Son, did you know without the benefit of carbon, we couldn't be grilling our hamburgers outside tonight just like the cavemen did who were created by God somewhere around 6,000 years ago, slightly after someone first wrote down the recipe for beer and bread.
No, Dad, I had no idea.
Well, son, that's one of the benefits of carbon. Benefits of carbon. But as I said, there are morons, and then there are morons, and some are intentional and some are unintentional. Robert in Australia reminding me, don't forget the flat earthers and moon is a hologram, people. If you can face it, check YouTube for The Earth is Flat and The Moon is a Hologram. And from what I can tell, they really believe it. Oh, my God. Yeah. God. I'd like to let these idiots run all the way through, but sometimes it's simply impossible not to stop. Sometimes I have to go back and make sure that my lying ears aren't lying to me again. Too much. Much too much. And then, well, like I said, there are the climate change morons one gets accustomed to. And then there are the ones that you really just wish weren't. Let's start with the former and not the latter. You know where this is coming from, right? It has to. I mean, we're fresh out of David Gregory, so that means we're going to have to run over to Radio TV Rwanda.
President Obama in drought-ridden California Friday proposing a $1 billion fund to research and help communities deal with the effects of climate change. The president's case may seem a bit hard to make when the eastern half of the country is in the grips of a brutal winter, but as you...
So, wait, stop, all stop. Engines ahead, nothing. This, of course, is Chris Wallace, who, toward the end of his father's life, caused his father to probably believe that the milkman was more likely, well, never mind. You get the setup there? President Obama pitching the idea of a climate change fund of $1 billion out in California where there's a drought going on. While back east, that certainly seems unlikely because it's winter and it's cold. Chris Wallace cannot be that unutterably stupid. That's got to have something to do with him cashing his paycheck. That's got to have something to do with that ancient maxim about it's very difficult to get a man to believe something when his paycheck depends on him not believing it. We've got a lot of experience with that here in almost level West by God, Virginia, by the way, but never mind. So, well, it's going to be hard to pitch that plan with winter and everything because...
You heard the president say climate change accounts for everything from drought to floods. George, do you buy it?
No, and neither does science, but I'm...
Oh, goody! George Will is going to speak for science! That's almost better than, I don't know, the Pope speaking about parenting.
One of those who are called deniers. When a politician, on a subject implicating science, hard science, economic science, social science.
No, just let it roll, Bob, let it roll.
Says, the debate is over, you may be sure of two things. The debate is raging and he's losing it.
Climate change, I think it's fair to say, used to be a very hot topic, no pun intended. In fact, it used to be called global warming. Now, not so much.
If we had a better economy...
Wait, I want to hear the economic argument, since going back to Marsha, and we've got to do the cost-benefit analysis first. I want to hear this goober too. This is a goober by the name of Charles Lane.
Not so much.
If we had a better economy, I think people would have more of a luxury to worry about climate change.
Right, because see, it's because of unemployment that people can't worry about climate change, because when they're unemployed on a planet that no longer supports their being a living human being, well, then all the luxuries are gone. Because you got that, you get the Frank Luntz messaging there, worrying about climate change is a luxury. How much of a luxury is it in the Maldives? How much of a luxury is it in South Florida, which is going to be under flipping water inside of a century? We'll just build big seawalls, won't we?
Maybe you know, because I don't. When did global warming become climate change? When
it became climate change when you couldn't prove that there was much global warming anymore. You know.
Yeah, because, you know, the last 20 summers haven't been the hottest 20 summers ever on record. Oh, yeah, she's Kim Strassel. Is not Stossel, not Stossel. She does not have a porn stash, and she hasn't been out on the streets of New York showing what grifters homeless people are. Kim Strassel is just chuckling madly to herself because you can't prove that the globe is warming. Anybody got any space in some, say, 140-degree Australia? Is it supposed to be 140 degrees Fahrenheit? We can drop Kim Strassel in so she can laugh there instead.
The temperature didn't change, so suddenly we had to have this catch-all term that was responsible. I mean, it meant that any change in the weather somehow supported the theory.
God almighty! Any change in the weather supports the theory when there is not a credible climate scientist on the planet who will say anything of the sort. Weather is not climate. Climate is not weather. But, you know, for the octogenarian demographic over at Radio Rwanda, Marvelline, come in here. That Chris Wallace and his friends are just cracking it wise today. Oh, they're having a lot of fun at the liberals' expense with the climate change. And like I said, there are intentionals, and then there are unintentional morans for Moran Monday, and it gives me no joy to mention this, but I ran across it over the weekend, and I thought, Secretary of State John Kerry was in Indonesia Sunday, where they don't seem to have much trouble understanding climate change. There's a lot of countries on this earth that don't have any trouble at all understanding climate change. Sweden doesn't have any problem understanding climate change. Neither does Indonesia or Malaysia or Japan or, hell, even China. India has no problem understanding climate change. Mexico doesn't. Argentina doesn't. Brazil doesn't. France, even Germany, having pretty much chucked the Energiewende out the window, still doesn't have a problem not understanding climate change, or a problem understanding climate change. No. Everybody gets it, but stupid us, because we've got 25%, our population consists of 25% of the people think that the sun revolves around the earth. But John Kerry was there in Indonesia giving a climate speech. He said, among other things, the science of climate change is leaping out at us like a scene from a 3D movie. It's warning us. It's compelling us to act. He referred to climate change as the world's most fearsome weapon of mass destruction, which I'm sure at one and the same time drove the deniers and the Bomb Iran Yesterday crowd half crazy. And yet at the same time, I mean, the speech is about 45 minutes long, and we're not going to take time for it. But here's an excerpt.
When 97% of scientists agree on anything, we need to listen, and we need to respond. Well, 97% of climate scientists have confirmed that climate change is happening and that human activity is responsible. These scientists agree on the causes of these changes, and they agree on the potential effects. They agree that the emission of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide contributes heavily to climate change. They agree that the energy sources that we've relied on for decades to fuel our cars and to heat our homes or to air condition our homes, to all the things that provide us electricity like oil and coal, that these are largely responsible for sending those greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere. And they agree that if we continue to go down the same path that we are going down today, the world as we know it will change, and it will change dramatically for the worse. All of which are factual statements. The problem is, John Kerry has almost sole authority to put to bed the idea of the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. Guess what? He hasn't yet. And frankly, I'm guessing the folks out at Harris in Vegas and Reno you'd probably get pretty long odds. I mean, if you put down one, you might win 10 if he actually puts the kibosh on the damn thing. But I wouldn't bet on it. It's not going to happen. Well, we know it's not going to happen before November 2014, right? I mean, because there are elections, and elections are more important than the fate of the planet. Because politics are more important than human beings. Jeeves. And we know the other thing about saying that
going to Indonesia and saying that climate change is the world's most fearsome weapon of mass destruction, is that the country that's wielding that most fearsome weapon of mass destruction more than just about anybody else is us. By us, I mean the United States of America. Ouch. According to Oil Change International, who has an analysis out of the scenarios employed by the State Department in issuing its pretty much bogus analysis of the environmental impact of the Keystone XL pipeline, well, they note that the State Department failed to take into account the targets by the Obama administration to reduce greenhouse gases by 17% by 2020. By the way, 17% may be wholly ineffectual in this discussion. Really? You can read this over at priceofoil.org. In which they write, all of the scenarios used by the State Department result in emissions that put us on a path to 6 degrees Celsius, 11 degrees Fahrenheit, of global warming, according to the International Energy Agency. Hey, look, they're still using global warming. I thought there wasn't any warming any. Oh, never mind. Ms. Strassel is just a radio TV Rwanda idiot. IEA Chief Economist Faith Birol described 6 degrees as nothing short of a catastrophe for all of us. Yeah. None of the scenarios modeled in the final supplemental environmental impact study, as noted in this report, none of the scenarios modeled a world in which the United States meets its stated goal of limiting climate change to less than 2 degrees Celsius. Despite the fact, they continue to write, that even these flawed models revealed that the carbon impact of the pipeline could equal as much as 5.7 million automobiles per year. This thing is well worth the read. Again, priceofoil.org. Kerry's State Department ignored Obama's climate action plan. And just one more thing. Point out, it's awfully hard to talk about climate change, and this is because, well, this program emanates from where it emanates. It's awfully hard to talk about wanting to prevent climate change when permit after permit after permit after permit has been granted and permits are expanded upon. To continue to blow up more mountains for more coal that we will ship overseas or else we'll burn in domestic coal-fired power plants. You just can't do it without... Yeah, isn't it the very essence of hypocrisy? It certainly seems to be. By the way, do you remember what was it last week, maybe week before? We were talking about the Australian company that has the brilliant idea of wanting to set fire to coal beds that they can't reach by traditional mining methods and just siphon off the gases from it. And, of course, they'll be ruining at least a big chunk of a significant aquifer in Wyoming to do it, but nevertheless. Well, that's not all. Let's talk about a company, oddly enough a Canadian company, called U.S. Oil Sands. And over at DSmog Blog, a favorite site for coverage of this sort of thing of ours, over at DSmog Blog, Ann Landman writes about this company, U.S. Oil Sands, Inc., joined by Albert, Brother Albert. Are you out there? If you are, sit down. Let's just read Ann Landman's words. In October, U.S. Oil Sands, Inc. joined Kentucky-based Arrakis Oil Recovery as the second company to receive a permit to produce U.S. tar sands. The Utah Water Quality Board gave U.S. Oil Sands a permit to extract 2,000 barrels of oil per day from Utah's tar sands reserves. Yes, and Arrakis Oil Recovery. Blessed be the maker. He has laced his boots hillbilly style. What can this mean? No, they're going to start trying to produce tar sands oil in Utah. And guess what else? I heard about this courtesy of our old buddy, Matt Osborne. There's apparently a veritable frenzy of this going on. Dateline Wolf Springs, Alabama, Stan, you know, of course. Article by Russ Corey in the Florence Times Daily. A company that wants to strip mine oil-bearing Hartzell sandstone in northwest Alabama could boost the economy, but residents are concerned about adverse effects to the environment, groundwater, property values, and rural roadways. At least he got it in a little bit better order where they weren't worried about the economy first. Although the economy does get first billing insofar as strip mining the hell out of northwest Alabama is going to bring an economic boom. Seems like it might be time for me to schedule a trip back to the old stomping grounds. Hello? Wake up! That's me. Standing on the rooftop screaming, hello? You don't want strip mining in your neighborhood, ever, at all. MS Industries has been in the area since summer 2010, operating out of a mobile home office on the site of an old gas station on Lawrence County 236. The company's drilled about 1,200 core samples in parts of Colbert, Franklin, and Lawrence counties, trying to find the best and most accessible deposits of the mineral from which it plans to extract crude oil. Company officials say they're sensitive to the concerns of the community, damn tree huggers, and the effect operations will have on the landscape, who gives a damn. MS Industries is a mining research and development company, said John Christmas, no really, of Mississippi, MS Industries' chief operations officer. John Christmas said the company plans to extract the mineral through surface mining, then transport it to an enclosed processing facility where oil will be extracted from the rock. The oil will then be sold to a refiner, after which it will be shipped overseas. Shh, that part's not in the story. But it's a global market, right? He said the extraction process would be similar to mining limestone rock from quarries.
It's just like that.
Requiring blasting and heavy equipment. Really? Blasting? Oh, hi, Shoals area. Can I tell you about ultra-fine particulate matter? You're going to love them. Little teeny tiny, less than 10 microns in size hunks of cancer, and birth defects, and heart disease, and pulmonary dysfunction. You want some of that. He said the extraction process would be similar to mining limestone rock. Okay, we got that. He said the mineral itself and the extraction process is nothing like the controversial extraction of tar sands found in Alberta, Canada. The process is completely different, Christmas said. When people try to group all oil sands and all processes in the same group, that's just not accurate. Oil sands in Canada are malleable, while the Hartzell Sandstone MS Industries wants to mine is a hard black rock. Oh, really? Hard black rock? I know a little bit about hard black rock. Got a lot of it up here. Hey, hey, hey. While strip mining can leave permanent scars on the landscape, Christmas said MS Industries has a remediation plan that involves restoring the property to the condition it was in before the mining began. Yeah, every mountaintop removal operation in Central Appalachia has one of those plans, too. And there's even a legal standard. It's called AOC, Approximate Original Contour. Hint! Hint! Less than 3% of all areas mountaintop removed in Central Appalachia have ever been fully, completely reclaimed within the meaning of the law. We have a land development management and remediation program. We're not going to leave any holes. That's a requirement under the surface and mining permit in the state of Alabama. You have a duty to remediate. And who's going to enforce that? Because remember, Alabamistan doesn't believe in government anymore. So we get all the way through this. By the way, in the Wolf Springs area south of the Shoals area, which is in the northwest corner of Alabama and is beloved to me, they've leased north of 2,000 acres. In the Wolf Springs area. And then there's an adjacent tract owned by Stephen Smith, CEO of MS Industries. And they're also leasing and buying property in Colbert County. And you got to get all the way down through umpty bajillion paragraphs between you get a subhead before you get a subhead called Residents Concerned. Shirley Cohn said the company's signs are on a fence of neighboring property in the Foxtrap Road area. Wolf Springs, Foxtrap Road. You get the idea that once upon a time there was actually real live, honest to God, nature in this area? They've been out there burning brush piles, Cohn said. This is the third generation to own this land we're on, she said. We plan to pass it on to our children and grandchildren. We're not in favor of strip mining at all. I've seen strip mines, and I know what they look like when they're finished with them. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Then there's LaGrange resident Jimmy Looney, and he's not crazy about the plans either. He says there's MS industry signs on fences all along Spring Valley Road down Colbert County way. He says, it has me concerned because they're buying property all around me. They're paying high prices for land, and people are seeing dollar marks instead of looking down the road. You want to conceive of the size and scope of this potential disaster? The Hartzell sandstone deposits spread from Morgan County to the Mississippi state line, and then they extend into northern Mississippi. It is a natural mixture of sand, clay, water, and bitumen, you know, the same stuff that's in the tar sands, bitumen. When extracted from the sands, bitumen can be converted to refinery-ready crude oil. Well, no mention in there of the monstrous human and environmental cost involved. Just a little bit of catch-up work. Darlene with a note, don't bash Bill Nye. No, I wasn't bashing. I'm just questioning the value of it. Darlene says, I don't want to see Bill Nye getting blamed by liberals, progressives for trying to debate the issue within the confines of the establishment media machine. I certainly think it's beneath him to be debating an idiot like Marsha Blackburn, but my guess is that Bill Nye sees the situation as so dire, and it is, that he has to speak out. I wish he was more forceful and had good zinger-like comebacks to completely reduce David and Marsha to nothing but black splotches on the pavement, but we are talking about a scientist who teaches science to children in the same vein as Mr. Rogers. He is a soft-spoken, sweet man, and maybe he hopes he can teach Marsha something. I see David Gregory along with Marsha Blackburn as the moronic idiots. Sorry for the redundancy, but I think the situation warrants it. And the network that spews his show forth is something legitimate, totally despicable for trying to promote the illusion that someone like a Marsha Blackburn is anywhere near Bill Nye's level in this discussion. Why not have a scientist of equal credentials who claims climate change, global warming isn't happening debate Nye? Well, that's right. Gregory and the producers of his idiotic show probably couldn't find one. There you go. Or else maybe their advertisers told them, you know, bring Marsha on. We give her a lot of money. We got to let her get out and get a little windshield therapy every now and then. Dr. John with a couple of comments. He said, I wish Bill Nye had gone down the cost-benefit road, as in, great point, and I'm glad you agree that we need to recognize the social costs of increased carbon emissions. So I hope you'll introduce legislation to compel ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Alpha Natural Resources, et al., to pay for cleaning up the cleaning up Hurricane Sandy and the 17 named winter storms we've had this season. There's a lot of people suffering from lost wages because of impossible travel, as well as inflated heating oil costs due to this unusually severe winter, all caused by climate change. Yeah, you'd like to see that. Yeah, Arrakis Tar Sands Company was not lost on Dr. John. Well, they got one thing right, he says. Arrakis. Dune. Desert planet. Yeah. And I am proud to announce that that Dr. John's challenge has been met for this evening. Thanks go out to Asa and to Betsy and to Ed for helping us do that. Thank you all very, very much, Dr. John's challenge having been met. In the first hour of the program. So that takes care of fundraising for this evening, and we'll worry about tomorrow, won't we? So thank you all very much, and we are done with fundraising for this evening. Thank you. Like I said, it's a bushel basket more and Monday. And it's time to enter into the conversation radio portion of the program, which means you light up the phones, 304-658-3333. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. And, of course, email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. And you can reach me on Twitter, @BobKincaid, on Facebook, Bob Kincaid. See how easy it is? So let's get it going. And barring that, well, it's not like we're more and poor. It's more and Monday on the horn. Listener-supported conversation radio. I'm Bob Kincaid.
smash the radio. Smash the watch. Smash the camera. The rhythm is around me. The rhythm has control. The rhythm is inside me. The rhythm has my soul.
Yes, there's never a bad excuse to play Peter Gabriel, the rhythm of the heat. Peter Gabriel. Hour two of this Moran Monday on the horn, and lines open, 304-658-3333, like I said before, also open on Skype if you want to jump in that way, and let us go forthwith to the phones. By the way, a note from Sandra via Twitter, and I agree wholeheartedly. Only the American corporate media can make climate disruption a he said, she said issue. Only the American for-profit media would want to. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
If I knew that, I'd be there where it was, you know?
No, I do.
It's the same old story. Man, oh man, these guys cannot find newer, faster ways of disrupting the world and making more money, can they?
I think there's an open question as to whether this really amounts to making more money, because they're only making more money for so long as they are allowed to externalize the costs upon the innocents.
Yeah. Well, Bob, what's your opinion about this whole oil situation? Now, we've heard for years that we're running out of this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, deny this. But maybe this is why they're going to the most extreme forms of ways.
Precisely. All the peak oil models, all the oil depletion models, unless I'm horribly mistaken, say that you know the more scarce it becomes, the more extreme methods will be used to extract it.
Yeah.
And let me just say that if you're trying to extract oil out of Northwest Alabama, out of sandstone rock, you've gone extreme. Never mind extreme sports. It's extreme hydrocarbon energy that may well, if this whole little human evolutionary experiment is going to fail, you know, evolution won't fail us. We will fail ourselves because we did not use the big brains that were given us for purposes of survival, but instead for purposes of transient, fleeting, temporary, imaginary wealth.
Is there anybody really digging into the future of overall energy consumption and use and keeping society going with, you know, like minor details like electricity and such?
No, there's certainly projections out there of worldwide energy use, and it's just going to go up and up and up and up. For the next 50 or so years, you know, after that, maybe the deluge. But apparently, we are on a collision course with reality, and you can't hold the desires against the developing world. I mean, Western Europe and the United States used it profligately for 150 years,
yeah.
And now it's India and China's turn, and they figure, do you blame them when their burgeoning middle class looks up and goes, well, you know, we'd like a car.
Well, cars can be, you know, their science has ways of developing new things, don't they, Bob?
Well, it's like what Bill Nye said. You know, the person who invents the better storage battery,
yeah,
is going to get really rich really fast.
Well, in many ways, they're better than they used to be.
Sure they are.
Well, I hear some of the old radio shows brought to me by my friend from Colorado through his connection, Kevin, you know.
Yeah.
And you hear somebody, Signal Oil was a West Coast oil company, and they're bragging about their batteries that lasted 3 years. Storage batteries.
Right.
Hmm.
But see, the technology is still at a fairly youthful phase. I was talking to someone, for instance, who owns a Toyota Prius. And they have taken good care of their Prius, and they're 8 years out. And it's time for a new battery. Mm-hmm. Care to guess?
How many thousand?
Four.
$4,000, huh? And what's a new one cost?
No, that is the new.
I don't even think about counting that high anymore about cars.
Yeah, that's the cost of the new battery.
$4,000 for the new battery.
Mm-hmm.
And what, $30,000 for the car?
Well, no, you can buy a new Prius for $22,000.
Oh, only $22,000. Well, yeah, that's, you know, is that part of the game, too, is to sell you that new vehicle constantly, which, you know, back in the 50s, it was a constant every year extreme model change was, you know, a cattle prod for some people to purchase a new car every 3 years and purchase in the stance of extending the loan, you know, and losing a few thousand every time. I mean, The story we used to, if you had a brand new car and you drove it off the lot, when I say you bought it for $3,000, you just lost $700 driving it off the lot.
Right.
So I don't even know today what.
Yeah, good. You know, your signature costs you 10% of the value of the automobile, right? I mean, that's what it used to be.
Yeah. Because look at years ago. How about that? In fact, running around my neighborhood when I was. You know, somewhere between 18 and 25, there's an old lady who had a Stanley steamer. You'd see it periodically. So at one point in time, steam would run a car, wouldn't it? The Germans were running all kind of ersatz automobiles, automotive stuff in World War II because they just couldn't get the... Well, hell, where could they get oil in Europe? The Ploesti oil fields in Romania?
That was one of them, yeah, because deep offshore drilling had not yet been developed. And, yeah.
Well, they developed a big interest in North Africa and such. And, of course, if I'm not mistaken, the British were battling the Iraqis after World War I. Mesopotamia, as they call it.
Right, who wanted the freedom that they'd kind of been promised for opposing the Ottoman Empire during, yes.
Mm-hmm. And Saudi Arabia seemed, how did they get it as well as they did? What's this? Somebody's trying to reach me, but that's okay.
Saudi Arabia just happened to be sitting on vast reserves.
Okay.
And so too was Iraq. And they were ruthlessly exploited. And at the time, it was, I guess, a good thing, ruthlessly exploited by British Petroleum and the Arab American Oil Company, Aramco in Saudi Arabia,
yeah,
and BP in primarily Iran.
Well, I remember one thing that was really bugged the hell out of the British was we sent them five battleships to dock up there at Scapa Flow with the British fleet during World War One. It was a sign of our friendship. Here, take these. And ours were running out of oil. And the British Admiralty was just incensed because they were still burning coal, Bob. And there was instances where a ship would pull into a neutral port to get a German battleship, or I shouldn't say battleship, because they were fighting boats, but they weren't battleship was another. What they call them, dreadnoughts was a name.
Yeah, that was one of them.
Yeah, and they'd go in there to get coal from a neutral country, and they would draft every German that lived there was out there loading coal, businessmen and other types that. Well, at least the bastards had to work for their country.
And that was, you know, that was a really, really bad way, as the explosion of the main proved, that was a really, really bad way to run a battleship.
Yeah. Well, that's another story, that main is.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some skullduggery involved, too, but if you're toting around massive amounts of coal, bad things happen.
Well, what I forgot about, and the thing that was mentioned in the damn 8th grade history book was the German battle fleet and the U.S. fleet squaring off at one point. I guess the Germans wanted the Philippines. Yeah, they thought that was a... You know, they were scurrying around the world late in... How many... I always looked at the countries that developed financially late, you know, like late 19th or early 20th century.
Well, the thing that hindered the Germans more than anything else was... The whole access to the ocean problem.
Yep. The North Sea was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a really good study, Castles of Steel, which I've read two or three times already, which is a study of the two battle fleets. You know, we talked about that Chinese beer, Tsingtao, and
yeah.
How it was first developed by a bunch of Germans. We're in a naval-based colony that they leased from on the coast of China. And, hell, don't give a German a place with no beer. You talk about a cause of war. There's one right there. German without beer is an unknown quantity. In fact, Saturday, a buddy of mine, a guy who played second guitar on that Stress Live album, he picked me up and we went to a restaurant named the Balaton. Balaton, of course, is a lake, I believe, outside of Budapest, where the name came from. Ah, that schnitzel, Bob. What can I tell you? You feel like a rich guy when you sit down and eat that stuff.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, getting back to the it's the money. We used to have a saying in the 70s that we used over and over again, follow the money, follow the money. That was the answer to most everything. But how did they convince, well, again, Bob, it's terrible because I can make enemies when I talk about how economics drags people into things. Like the most terrible part of our economics, the aspect of one man owning another man. Which... The worst part of it was official slavery, but wage slavery was not far behind it. There's been a couple good studies of the draft riots in New York City, and how the Irish were living in New York was the only thing better than it was that you didn't pick cotton and nobody beat you with a whip. Or split your family up by selling parts of it to other parts of the country, you know? Those things are just... You can't get any worse on a human behavior scale than owning another person. And the thing about slavery was it was outright ownership. But when you look at the Gilded Age, it was half outright ownership. And the finance company and the charge account card and... all these wonderful things that we have developed in our part, our time in the world, are in other parts of one man owning another. But what really, I think, gets you and bothers me is that in so many ways, say coal in West Virginia, these companies have taken a massive step backward in the treatment of their fellow human beings. They've gone on the hell with you, you know?
Sure.
I don't know, how's the, something you haven't talked about lately, any more crap coming out of the mine and hitting the river?
Not since the last one. I had a story from the other day that Devin had provided me from here in Fayette County, where they were accepting toxic waste from fracking. But that's a kind of a done deal here. There's a hearing scheduled for it was scheduled for this evening. I guess it's either underway or maybe wrapped up by now, because this state has moved with, you know, things kind of roll slow in Appalachia unless our betters decide that they need to roll fast, Bill.
Yeah.
And they needed to roll fast on fracking waste. Solid. See, everybody tends to think of liquid waste from fracking.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of solid waste, too.
Well, whatever they're pulling out of there has to go somewhere.
And so there was a public hearing this evening on a bill that was that is intended to exempt landfills from limits on tonnage that they can accept from fracking. Now, I might mention that this stuff is frequently radioactive.
Oh, I didn't know that. See, I'm, you know me, Bob. Science is probably the weakest area of my life. It has to do with a lot of it with parochial schools. I mean, they didn't offer biology until the 10th grade.
I didn't. No, that's when you get biology.
Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't do it. I don't remember much science courses at all in parochial school in the 50s and early 60s. Because that was, you know, that in certain areas, certain religious areas, that science fell right alongside witchcraft.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
As far as they thought. It's just, you know, it just boggles my mind the more you talk. Because when you start talking mineral science and
mineral industries.
Industries, yeah. You see, I'm not very hip at all to that. I mean, I knew about coal because, my God, everybody was burning it when I was. I remember standing on a grate above the furnace when I'm 5 years old, you know, with the typical short pants and the whole nine, Bob, and saying, boy, this is warm and cozy. Of course, I had no knowledge of how this warm and cozy was affecting my future.
No, you just wanted to be that way.
No, it sure beats the hell out
and
of me.
But see, Bill, that kind of opens the door on a larger discussion, and that is, and it's something that Bill Nye mentioned in the clip. There's no debate on the, I mean, it took us 150 years to radically alter the climate of the planet, and there is no debate on that.
No, there can't be. Because it has changed. It is just, well, even the guys that were doing, I told you about that strip mining. In fact, they have a big shovel down there that had a name, and some band in Cleveland adopted that name for their dance band. Okay. You know, people are strange. And all those pits they had down there, the strip mining pits, they had converted them into water.
Lakes, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're
knocking with fish.
Yeah, one of the things that blew my mind in the midst of all the green energy revolution that I happened to witness in Germany a couple of years back, well, just to sort of make sure that I didn't get all starry-eyed, I was taken to see this vast open pit lignite mine that if it expand, I mean, they were already clearing out 1,000-year-old villages to you know, they were depopulating them, moving people away, so that they could expand this great big hole in the ground, and they said it would be the 40 years from now when it's done, it'll be the second largest freshwater lake in Europe. That's how big this open pit coal mine is.
Jesus.
And I'm, you know, I just said to my genial hosts, I said, 40 years from now, I wouldn't want my children in that. And And it's that question of the long arc. You know, Dr. King said the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Isn't that what he said?
Well, I hope he was correct.
Well, the problem, though, is that we as human beings lack the ability, unless we make a conscious effort toward it, to consider the long arc of existence. Because, and that goes to something I was saying while the in the early days of the ongoing disaster here.
There must be a magazine sales drive going on. Go ahead.
and that is, you have people trying to live without water for, you know, frequent bathing and things like that, whose forebears would not have been at all shocked by that. But in the so-called modern era, bathing every day is something that you do.
Yeah, theoretically, yes. I was a too bad a day guy when I was owning my own home and getting up first thing in the morning to go grease myself to hell and back on a car or some kind of house project, and then taking another one at night.
Oh, by the way, a little update coming in from Todd in the chat room. He said, Bob, the drag line in Bucyrus, Ohio, is Big Musty.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
But we lack, just to sort of return to the general theme, we lack an ability to take a long view. Except for those peoples who are close enough to their heritage and close enough to the earth that they say things like, we consider all decisions seven generations out. And what is that, 280 years?
Yeah, figure that, yeah. Rounded to that.
Well, get me a room. Let's just take a random room full of Americans, Bill, and ask them to tell us about the world they expect their progeny seven generations out to live in. What's that world going to look like?
Hell.
Well, no. See, you say that, and I fear that. But I would say that I would hypothesize that the majority of people are unable to imagine any world that is much different from the world they're in, unless, you know, maybe they'll posit what our old buddy Reverbo used to talk about, you know, when do we get the helium filled pants?
Yeah.
When do all of those technological marvels that you were witness to their, you know, you were witness to their prognostication when you were young. Think about all the things that were going to be coming our way in just a very few short years that were posited during the heady optimism coupled with, of course, the horror of the Cold War of the 1950s.
Yeah.
I mean, we were going to have flying cars, right? We were going to have jetpacks.
Yeah. And hell, it was a TV. What was that TV show, cartoon show, The Jetsons?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Jane, stop this crazy thing.
Yep, there was all. Well, somebody mentioned. There was a band. The band name I was trying to think of the other when I said there was a band named after that. They call the band Cyrus Erie.
Bucyrus Erie was the manufacturing company that made all those things.
Made those big cranes and lifters and because those things fascinated. Did you go through a thing where you were ogling after these truck models and such of these big construction things?
Oh, sure.
And that was before after my time. But by that time, I was driving the damn things and trying to go inside them and make them different. That's what I would call the old American way to me. Take something and take something out of your backyard and make it better. Make it work better. That was what the middle class relied on, the self-reliance thing, Bob. And man, you talk about it, you're still.
Well, but I think, Bill, that was a carryover from a previous life. And I don't mean like reincarnation. I mean, those were skill sets that were passed on from literally frontier days.
Yeah, I remember my mom's brother teaching me to how to paint a car, and I'm laying underneath the car one time, and my hair was kind of long in those days, and the old boy was standing on my ear, you know, geez, every time you moved, you know. And he's telling me, well, I'll do this, and I'll do that, and, you know, it works. You know, because I think you've worked a lot with Ferg as far as teaching him the ropes of the business you're in.
I've taught him some, but I'm still not willing to turn him loose behind a microphone.
Well, he'll get there.
One of the and the thing is, if you're going to do that, the way you do that is the way I did it, and the way, you know, oodles of other old jocks did it. You got the minimum wage job. And you graduated up to doing the midnight shift, and then maybe they trusted. Well, I started out doing 7 to midnights, playing, you know, the Happy Goodman family and the Chuck Wagon gang and the Statler brothers and what have you.
One of my buddies, there's one guy in the building who I live with who was the first human being I ever played standing alongside in a folk era with her. He would play guitar and sing, and I'd play behind the guy. That was my first time of standing up with that damn little thing in my hand and trying to make something out of it. Because I had to give up on the fact that I don't care how many hours I spent with that clarinet in my mouth, I'd never be Benny Goodman or George Lewis, the New Orleans clarinetist. It was just too much, Bob. That's a son of a bitch to play that thing correctly. That's why it's such a lost instrument today. It has no place to go. Well, polka bands still use them.
Right.
And that's about it, you know, as far as there's no future there at all with that with that instrument. Yet it was one of the kings of the 30s. You know, Goodman, Artie Shaw, and before that. Do you ever hear much of the early Armstrong stuff?
I have heard some, but not a whole bunch, no.
Try the Hot 5 and the Hot 7 with the Dodge Brothers and Kid Ory on trombone and Louis' wife, Lillian Harden, playing piano. Yeah, that was a tremendous outfit. But it's just the idea that I guess we used to be able to do a lot of things, but science has jumped way ahead in a lot of areas, consumer consumption areas, for instance, you know. I couldn't begin to tell you anything about the television sets that are currently being purchased. But yet I knew how to take one with tubes or transistors and figure out what was wrong with it and make the son of a bitch work again. But you had to spend a lot of money to do it. You had to buy all kind of test equipment. You know, and go from there. I don't know, maybe there was something... Well, look at the guys that worked in the mines, Bob. You don't tell me that there wasn't a million and one tricks in the bag of those guys?
Oh, sure. Most of them wound up building their own homes.
Yeah. Well, and the old radio shows, when they talk about the American way, I think that's what they were talking about. The spirit of the do-it-yourself spirit that kind of ran things. You had to know how to do it just to survive on it. Well, I won't keep you, but I'll leave you with a sick laugh. One of the commercials, Bob, there's nothing like listening to old Roy Rogers radio broadcasts. And it's sponsored by Post Toasties, which I don't even think is in business anymore.
Now, did Post get absorbed by someone?
Possible.
Yeah, Post Toasties were the competition for Kellogg's Corn Flakes.
Yep, absolutely. And the commercials they would do, the guy would say, this is the best thing done with corn since the Indians discovered it. I mean, my God, I was surprised.
Discovered it? Really?
Yeah.
Well, there goes that 10,000 years of careful, patient breeding and crossbreeding and hybridization. Well, never mind.
Well, made me wonder, did they grow corn in Europe?
No.
They didn't, huh? How come?
Didn't exist.
Not until they discovered it here.
Right.
To take it back.
Yeah, see, that's where people get confused, because the literalists who believe that the King James Bible is the received word of the living God.
Yeah, those people, yes.
The word corn, C-O-R-N, exists in the English language older than and utterly independent of maize.
Yeah.
Corn referred to huge hunks of salt.
Huh.
Or grain and things that were in pieces roughly grain size, grain things. So to corn beef is to treat beef with salt so as to preserve it. And when the Bible says corn, that's the King James Version, by the way, which is written post discovery of the New World. Discovery. Huh, there's another one of those. There's another one of those freighted privilege words. But they're talking about grain, whether it be barley or wheat or rye or millet or corn.
Yeah, that was part of the type of hunter. Was it hunter gatherers or what? The type of people to begin to develop the art of eating stuff that grew in the ground.
Oh, well, no, what you get, yeah, you're talking about the transition from hunter-gatherer into a sedentary agricultural society.
Yeah.
Yeah, that first comes about in an area that's referred to as the Fertile Crescent.
Okay, that would be a
the funny thing is, like with Mesopotamia, one of the first hard lessons they learned out of sedentary agriculture is, hey, we screwed up the ground and it won't grow anything anymore. How about that? We effed ourselves.
Too much.
Well, if you irrigate long enough, you will salinate the soil.
Yeah. And, well, we use so much fertilizer here that I begin to wonder sometimes about what I'm eating. And, I eat enough of it, so I shouldn't worry, you know. I guess that's the idea. As long as the stomach is full, don't worry about what you put in it. But, yeah, you hit it, man, Bob. My first wife gets me thinking. She could make chopped chicken liver, make your hair stand on end. It was so good.
Oh, God. Really, really well made chopped liver with the schmaltz and the onions.
Oh, yeah. As I said, her last name being like what has four legs, you know.
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Mrs. Katz and her lawyer.
Wendy could cook, and my second one could take chicken liver and make a gravy and onions and cheeses.
Mm.
That's one thing.
I love chicken livers. I do.
Yeah.
I'm frequently told that that's not something you want to eat anymore when you consider how chickens are produced.
Yep. Well, there was a guy who.
But Lord, when they're good, they're good.
A college professor at Cleveland State would show up on an afternoon locally produced television show, and he'd talk about how much arsenic they were shooting into them, so they were marketable quicker. And that's something that, you begin to wonder after a while, because we, agribusiness, is that business part of it. That's another one of those minor things that we have to deal with. It's bad enough we have to deal with air, but you don't know what the hell they're selling you. Didn't Bush drop off a lot of the food inspection people?
And Obama is continuing in that same vein.
Same way.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful.
Because now we're going to let chicken producers inspect themselves, even though the pilot project suggests that will lead to an increase in things like E. coli infestations.
We'll go back. Maybe I was privileged that they made us read books like The Jungle.
Well, I was going to say pretty soon somebody's going to have to rewrite that, or else we're going to have to reread it.
Well, I won't.
But all these things are coming back around. It's like I've mentioned before that I'm really weary of people saying, well, why don't those West Virginia people just move? And the first thing that comes to mind for me is, yeah, because the Grapes of Wrath worked out so well.
Yeah. Well, that's always hit me hard about the, what's the city in California that, has produced some of the finest modern country guys? Bakersfield.
Bakersfield, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder, don't some of those guys realize and know how their family ended up in Bakersfield? Coming up through the beat-up cars and the trash of how they were treated going across from, this Oklahoma to California?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Woody Guthrie, what was the song he wrote? California's a Garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see, but... believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you don't have that do-re-mi. So Woody was on the money. But I'll let you go with one thing about these commercials for the cornflakes. While the guy was spieling, in the background you heard this you know, the beat of a tom-tom type drum, and a chorus of people singing, now get this one, Post Toasties Heap Good Cornflakes.
Oh, for pity's sakes.
And
you know, that persists all the way into the 70s. I remember a margarine ad that was made of, and the margarine was made of corn oil, of course.
Yeah.
And you've got some woman dressed up as a native female who is holding up a stalk, holding up an ear,
yeah.
And she says, maize, you call it corn. And it's like, really?
Oh, yeah. Is that what you call amazing? Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. Proud of you for it.
But, yeah, this kind of stuff, there's nothing like these radio shows that have these old commercials in it. And you listen to the sales points of this stuff. And you just sit here and shake your head and say, they're still using the same concept. They just changed the words. But, you know, the inception is still the 8 or 10 year old mind is what they're laying it out for in commercials. Anyway, I'll let you go, but that's, you know, one of the weakest parts of my educational background. Maybe that's what I would have gotten if I had taken the college level courses, but science never interested me as much as the stuff that has gone on ahead of us, the stuff that people did before us. Because that gets you a good look at the sociology of how you're living now. And, of course, that was the big word in my mind was always, why? Why? Why do we do things this way?
Sure.
And, Bob, if I had all the answers, I'd be around for it. But last night I had a rough one. I was shaving and nicked myself and I couldn't get it to stop bleeding. That's because of medications.
Yeah.
You talk about a guy, I had to call the damn fire department to come in. I had no, those guys have been really helpful to me, but I don't have everything in this house that I should have, like Band-Aids. You know, a lot of things get
maybe now it's time to grow the beard, Bill.
I did that already. As
I was going to say, we'll send you the bongos and the beret.
Well, I had a picture of on the floor playing with one of my dogs who was a female, and she had a couple kittens that she was applying the tongue to. You know, that maternal instinct sometimes it goes from humans to animals and back and forth. And I'm laying there on the floor, and I looked at, I was probably 39, 40, and I looked at the amount of gray in the beard, in the goatee. Because that first LP, the blackface thing that...
Yeah.
That I was wearing, I wore a goat for years. I don't know why. Just lazy son of a bitch doesn't like to shave, you know? That's just the way it goes. And that was so typical of the 60s, the rebirth of the mustache and beards, which had, what was that, 1890s style stuff?
Yeah.
What goes around comes around, Bob. Anyway, I'll get off of here and let somebody else come on and go around for a while. Take care of yourself.
All right, you be good, Bill. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, and just because he mentioned it and sometime, and you know, Bill has a way of inspiring the old DJ in me a little something.
I can hear. A thousand miles of farming.
streets of Bakersfield. They threw this drunk man in my jail cell. I took $15 from that man. Left him my watch and my old house key. Don't want folks thinking that I'd steal. And I thanked him as I was leaving. And I headed out for Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Bakersfield. Hey, you don't know me, but you don't like me. Say you're careless how I feel. But how many of you listen to just me ever walk the streets of Bakersfield?
Dwight Yoakam and Buck Owens, Streets of Bakersfield from, golly, Moses, 1988. Holy cow. I love the road that Bill was taking us down a couple of, because about, you know, what does it mean to be successful as a species? I mean, the Saurians were on this planet for hundreds of millions of years and were at least in part wiped out by forces beyond their own control, to wit, giant asteroid. These things happen. There's some trash floating around in space. There's an asteroid making a very near miss tonight or something. I guess you can watch it online, or I don't know. I haven't had a chance to fully check it out. But, yeah, well, I mean, it's all just a mass of hurtling stuff that's still busy hurtling outward from the Big Bang. It gets trapped in little orbits and moves around, and yeah. But the thunder lizards, you know, the dinosaurs, were very successful. We've been on this planet for next to no time whatsoever, and by far the largest amount of time that we have we've been here, we have been most successful not from the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution forward. I think if you begin to write a sort of post-mortem on the human race, at least an early draft, then you have to say that this was our least successful period. It's in the Industrial Revolution that you get mass starvation for no reason other than the imposed, some frequently artificial scarcity of resources. There's a compelling argument to be made that the most successful period in human evolution happens before the rise of farming. And I realize if you had that sampling of Americans that I was talking about a few minutes ago together, ooh, ick! Walking around in skins and eating grubs and roots and... Those folks were better at being human beings than we are. By a long shot, for heaven's sakes. Imagine the Clovis culture and having a conversation with them and saying, well, you know, how do you feel about it? Oh, we feel pretty successful. I mean, we got this really cool point, and it's just rendered, it's been a great technological leap. And we figure, we figure we'll be around for a while. And they were. But whether you're talking about hunter-gatherer peoples or sedentary peoples or modern industrial peoples, you know, scarcity will do you in. And we have practiced an economy of enforced scarcity. And how many people, if you walked into one of the average churches around here or around where you live and simply offered up the proposition, live simply so that others may simply live? How many people would get it? Or how many people would scream, "Communism! Jesus! Kill the heretic!" Right? Note coming in from Dr. John, going back to the corn question. He says, "Corn, I have fun with this in my archaeology intro classes. I show them this text from the Code of Hammurabi. If a tavern keeper..." This is a quote. It was probably first written down on one of those clay tablets that we were throwing onto the floor and breaking into a million tiny pieces when we first invaded Iraq, because we were more interested in protecting the oil ministry. Never mind. "If a tavern keeper does not accept corn according to gross weight in payment of drink, but takes money, and the price of the drink is less than that of the corn, she shall be convicted and thrown into the water." Dr. John says, "I read them this and I ask them simply, what does this document mean? And the students usually say something like, tavern keepers had to be paid in corn or money, so they still had a sort of barter system. I then launch into the corn story, how the code was translated by British English speakers, so by corn, the translator simply meant a small grain, likely barley. It's a great entree into talking about origins of agriculture, as well as the main point, which is that documents are not self-evident, but require interpretation." That probably needs carved on a wall somewhere. Documents are not self-evident, but require interpretation. Because if they're self-evident, then obviously that means that some very early Western Hemisphere people had rode all the way over to Mesopotamia and were maize, you call it corn, right? Code of Hammurabi is full of neat stuff like that. It was written around 1772 BCE, which is pretty impressive all by itself, which means that it is about 3,700 years old. Everybody laboring away at coming up with some way to make significant their own existence while they were busy trying to continue, existing. We are in the third hour of this Moran Monday on the Horn, and like I said, we have bushel baskets full of Morans. Double Moran nomination going out this evening to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Moran nomination going out to the folks who rejected unionization at the Volkswagen plant. But equally, a Moran nomination going out to the United Auto Workers, who apparently are capable of screwing up a one-car funeral or a one-car parade. And there's so many things here. Mike Elk over at In These Times, and just look it up, did a pretty darn good job with the postmortem. Pull together the whys and wherefores of how this thing fell apart. I mean, really, if you don't have opposition from your the company that you're trying to organize, and you still manage to lose, that's pretty screwed up. Well, that's exactly what the UAW did. And I know some people might think, oh, don't say bad things about the UAW. Look, we say bad. We're not saying bad things. We're pointing out realities. They screwed up. And yes, I know the monumental resources of a vast right-wing conspiracy. And yes, Corker was dirty. Bill Haslam, the governor of Tennessee, was dirty. They lied all over themselves. They threatened. They coerced. And they did, in short, what Southern politicians do when things aren't going a Southern politician's way. But they still couldn't muster, what was it, 86 votes? 87 votes is what it would have taken. No. They lost by 86 votes or 76 votes, something I don't recall wrong. But so in essence, a flip of like 36 or 40 votes would have made all the difference, and that would have been an organized plant. But there were a number of screw-ups in there, like the fact that the UAW had already negotiated some deal with Volkswagen before any potential members of the union that local that would organize there would have a chance to vote on it. And you couple that with the native suspicion that exists now for labor organizations in that region, not so much. But there are, and it's over at In These Times. Mike Elk does a good job covering labor. I know Mike. I consider Mike a friend. Along the way, though, he makes just a passing reference and doesn't really do anything with it. It's just a passing comment where he talks about the fact that outside union-sympathetic, labor-sympathetic organizations were trying to ally with the UAW, and the UAW was cold and standoffish to them. And in passing mentions the fact that on the pages of local papers and in local talk radio, the UAW was getting hammered day after day after day, caller after caller after caller, and I know what those calls sound like. We don't allow that filth on this program, but I know what it sounds like. I don't need no union. I'm happy making what I'm making. I work for what I make, and they pay me what they think is fair, and that's just murka. Or something equally asinine. I don't want some union boss in Detroit telling me how I got to do my job. That's JAWWWWB. Benny, I'm not saying they were paying people to call in. They don't have to. It's right-wing radio. It is self-sustaining. The idiocy buoys itself along upon the currents. But, when I read that passing remark in Mike Elk's story, couldn't help thinking about something. And that's this. Some of you long-time die-hard listeners to Progressive Radio may remember back in the heady late days of the century, early days of the first decade of this century, you may recall that there was a Progressive Radio network out there that was doing 12, 15, 16 hours a day of live origination radio, and it was all progressive to one degree or another. I mean, you had people like Hartman. You had people like Malloy. I can't remember. Tom Likas. There was a whole day-parted schedule there of people doing progressive radio. It was called IE America Radio. And it was run and funded by the United Auto Workers. And they farmed it out, syndicated it out to stations all over the United States. And you could also, and this was pretty neat considering the day, the era, you could get it online. And that's where I would go to listen to Malloy every evening. God, I think at one point in time on IE America, it wasn't even every evening. I think he was doing like 3 to 6 in the afternoon. You begin to see where I'm going? Well, the UAW had a national election for its national president, and the guy who won, Ron Diddlefinger or something like that, I can't remember, whatever. Ran on the platform of, by God, I'll shut that goddamn radio, progressive radio network we're running down. I'll shut her down, because we don't need that. Probably with the wrong accent, mind you. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. He was elected president of the union. And they took IE America Radio out back behind the barn and axe handled it to death and grinned and giggled the whole time they were doing it. So I read that passing reference in there about how they were getting slaughtered, the UAW was getting slaughtered on right-wing talk radio, and I thought, I wonder if maybe any of the geniuses at the UAW were thinking that maybe it would have been a good idea to have some sort of a countervailing argument on the radio airwaves, which they used to have. That maybe there might have been just one little itsy-bitsy flickering candle flame radio station somewhere in the Chattanooga market that you could have gone to if you wanted to hear an opinion contrary to the relentless stream of bashing of organized labor generally and the UAW in particular. So, it's worth thinking about because it is still a problem. If you go over to Politico, politico.com, Mackenzie Wenger did an article that came out over the weekend about labor's influence in progressive radio, and she had the good sense to go and talk to my buddy, Rick Smith, my colleague here on the Horn, who follows immediately after this program. And he talked at length about what needs to happen and what isn't happening. Unfortunately, it could have been a one-on-one interview with Rick, and it would have been far better than the piece that came out. But there's no getting around the fact that when you have people out there doing radio, calling themselves, saying that they are the voice of labor, who concomitantly at the same time are operating with, and I'm not talking about Rick Smith. Rick Smith is one of the absolute most talented individuals doing progressive talk in America today, period, bar none. But when you've got people out there saying that they are the voice of, one, claiming to be the voice of anybody is deeply offensive. I don't like it when people who don't live within 300 miles of a coal mine claim to be the voice of Appalachia. And frankly, if I was somebody who was out there as a member of a labor organization, who, you know, a union member, and had some guy with no talent whatsoever out there claiming to be the voice of labor, I'd be like, oh, we're screwed. Yeah, Ron Gettelfinger. That's his name. Thank you, Sparky. That's the guy that killed IE America. That's the guy who made sure that there was no pro-union voice to be heard in the shouting match. It was a one-sided shouting match. And that's the and that's just a that's a larger issue. It is a one-sided shouting match where terrestrial radio is concerned. So, yeah, that nomination has to be out as well. Here's what Mike Elk writes. He says, also, pro-union community activists who spoke within these times on condition of anonymity out of fear of hurting their relationships with the UAW spoke about difficulties in getting the UAW to help them engage the broader Chattanooga community. Many activists I spoke with during my two trips to Chattanooga said that when they saw the UAW being continually blasted on local talk radio, newspapers, and billboards, they wanted to get involved to help build community support. However, they say that the UAW was lukewarm in partnering with them. Indeed, when I attended a forum in December organized by Chattanooga for Workers, a community group designed to build local support for the organizing drive, more than 150 community activists attended, many from different area unions, but I encountered only 3 UAW members. Community activists said they had a hard time finding ways to coordinate solidarity efforts with the UAW, whose campaign they saw as insular rather than community-based. One anonymous commenter said, there's no way to win in the South without everyone that supports you fighting with you, because the South is one giant anti-union campaign. One giant anti-union campaign, and it is. But it has not always been that way. It has been transformed into that. When the South was industrializing, the job my father left West Virginia to take in Alabama, it was the same job, furnace operator, and it was the same union. He left a union job, went to a union job, and stayed a member of that union until such time as he was bumped upstairs into middle management. He got to be a foreman instead of an operator, and he said leaving the union was the biggest mistake he ever made in his life. So yeah, that nomination needed to go out there. One sec, please. Our eldest daughter is down at the hospital in Charleston. And I'm just trying to keep up with the messages I'm getting from Agnes regarding her well-being. Devin, with a good and insightful question in the chat room, why can't VW workers form a new union? Why must workers have only one union for their craft? And this is a very, very old question because, and I've been meaning to mention this. There's a little something email real quick. Dr. John, the Tennessee union issue, he said, that's really galling about the UAW since, as I understand it, the workers organized themselves and sort of had to bring in the UAW because that would be the natural home for the cooperative. Sam Cedar had a caller last week from Germany who talked about what happened when Volkswagen wanted to put solar panels on a factory. The workers' cooperative went to management and offered to pay for and handle the installation in return for a share of the profit. Basically, the union sold the power to VW and distributed the proceeds among the workers. Literally everyone benefited, including, you know, the earth. VW saved on power, the union had some extra work and a new revenue stream, and less fossil fuel got burned. It even works as a sort of job security since VW had to pay a bit less for a capital cost, meaning more money could go to labor. You hear something like that and suddenly the U.S. seems so backwards. Dr. John, it is past backwards. The one thing that struck me as the more I thought about it is that things like the labor councils and the non-hostility to labor unions were things that the United States built into the reconstruction of Germany and Japan. Now, Germany in particular had a previous history, but we reinforced it and said, no, really, this is the way to go. We exported it, and now the people to whom we exported it 70 years ago, 65 years ago, close enough, math on the fly, suck at it. The people to whom we exported it have tried in the form of the auto workers union at VW to export it back to us, and we are so goddamn backward. We are so up to our eyeballs in the stupid. We are so immersed in fear and terror and an inability to cope with anything in the way of self-determination that 35 or 40 idiots in Chattanooga were able to stop progress dead in its tracks. And even the UAW, which is not the UAW of the Ruthers, even the UAW would have been a progressive step forward. And, yeah, Dr. John, Peter Werby was a part of IE America. Dr. John says, I borrow a line from him all the time when someone calls me a liberal. It's, don't call me a liberal. I'm way more radical than that. True. So true. And thanks to Tony from Texas for helping out in tonight's fundraising. That is immensely helpful and important. And hopefully it means that, it does mean we'll have a little less to have to raise tomorrow, which is wonderful. I bet you think I'm running out of either gas or morons, don't you? Wrong. Oh, no, wrong. Just a quick little update of the ongoing disaster in West Virginia. Remember, it's only a disaster, according to Angela Logomassini of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, because, you know, we hillbillies lack perspective. Well, here's a little more perspective, courtesy of Mackenzie Mays writing at the Charleston Gazette. Grandview Elementary School in North Charleston closed today at 12:15 p.m. after complaints of a licorice-like odor associated with the January chemical spill into the Elk River. Several teachers complained of the odor and headaches this morning, according to Kanawha County Schools Maintenance Director Terry Hollinsworth, who responded to the complaint as part of a rapid response team assembled by the State Department of Education to inspect schools during the water crisis. Health Department, National Guard, and Department of Environmental Protection officials, all part of the team, made the decision to dismiss school early. They got there and they could smell a low odor, Hollinsworth said. I'll say it's low. And then later this morning, the team was inspecting similar complaints at Sharon Dawes Elementary School. Yes, yes indeed. The team already inspected Alum Creek Elementary School, where a black oily substance was found in one of the school's sinks. They blamed that on a bad feeder tube. Yeah, I heard some horror stories over the weekend listening to the radio. All along, you know, I knew just because it's human nature for the as long as we've been humans that somewhere on this planet somebody's having a baby most every day. Heard the story over the weekend of the young woman who was having water delivered to her, not by the government, not by the glorious military, but by a citizen group determined to not let people go without. Thanks, Earl Ray. No thanks to Earl Ray either. She was right at about to give birth when she took her first big old, drank her first big old glass full of poison deregulation water. Now she's got a little baby on the ground and she's trying to make formula for the baby without being able to get water from the tap. Now see, I said earlier that people were being asked to do what our ancient frontier ancestors did as a matter of course. But that's not entirely correct. Because our forebears, well, they had things like springs and creeks and even wells. They had places where the rock that forms the mountains of Appalachia, where there were places in the rock where cold, crystal clear, pure water would simply jet out between the cracks of a rock and all one had to do was drink. And that mama, with her first baby, her newborn, well, she didn't have any springs or creeks or wells. Because they've all been poisoned. That's why we have to have city water, which is also now, thanks to the coal industry, been poisoned. Charming. No? Yes. And I heard her story. And the horror became fresh in my mind once again. And I thought about darling, dear Angela Logo Messini and how I would love to have her come down to West Virginia and just sit there in front of a live camera for a webcast or something with her children all around her and say, "Here, babies, I get a paycheck and I cash it and it's how we live and I get paid for saying that chemical companies who poison people aren't nearly as bad as people think they are. Here, little Cindy. Here, little Timmy. Here, little Johnny. Here, little Susie. And here's one for Daddy and one for me. We're all going to drink a big glass of perfectly usable water." Because that's what Mommy has to do, because that's what Mommy gets paid by the... No, Mommy ain't doing that. Mommy going to live in the bubble up in D.C. or wherever the hell she is. Yeah, D.C. She's going to live in her bubble, and ain't nobody going to come down here and drink that water because you couldn't get her to drink this water on a damn dare. Thank you very kindly, Randy. You have just... Between you and Tony, you've made it so that our fundraising for tomorrow is only $75. Thank you very much. Twenty-five minutes past the hour. Lines are open if you want to jump into the conversation. 304-658-3333 or over there on the Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. They both work quite well. Yeah, you really can't hang on to this story for Wednesday, no matter how badly you want to. Because the Moran outweighs the religion by at least a little bit. Everybody's seen this by now, but we have to at least get his nomination out there because we won't be able to nominate him anymore because he has shuffled off this mortal coil and gone to his long home. Yeah. Jamie Coots is no more. Jamie Coots, snake handling minister from Kentucky, got bit again, and because he believed in the power of the Lord to heal him, well, he, as we say around here, up and died. He up and died. Apparently got bit at the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Jesus' Name Church. This guy had been made a star by reality TV on the National Geographic Channel program Snake Salvation. He died at about 10 o'clock Saturday night. He died about 10 o'clock Saturday night because ignorant people who don't understand what did you say earlier, Dr. John? Text is not self-evident. It has to be interpreted. Well, he didn't interpret. He took it literally. Mark chapter 16, and these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils. They shall speak with new tongues. They shall take up serpents. And if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. Did you notice in there that, okay, I'm going to interpret for a minute. It don't say in there the snake won't bite you. Interpretation. Documents must be interpreted. They are not self-evident. Goodbye, Jamie Coots. Goodbye. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey. I kind of thought that Nye lost when she busted out when he's an actor. Now, I know for us, that just sounds like, oh, my God, please. But, you know, he should stop because it just didn't really work. Because it shouldn't be a debatable, I mean, I just felt like he was being, you know, used because he's coming from a sincere place and she's coming from a funded place. So, you know, it's already tipped against him.
Right. Well, the thing was a fraud ab initio, as it were. And any time that you're engaged in a debate that can be interrupted by, and now we have to stop and run some commercials. You don't have any, I mean, even the so-called debate with Ken Ham was a little more straightforward because it was a back and forth and there were no commercial breaks, right?
Right.
But I even had issues with that. Sometimes I just want to ignore these people unless we're just having a damn good time laughing at them.
Oh, yeah, no, but I didn't, you know, I find the whole thing, you know, it's just going down the wrong way because, see, and of course, the media here, the way they sort of bastardize everything. Now, as we are watching the climate just go crazy right in front of our eyes.
The England thing is blowing my mind.
Yeah, the way it's being propagandized in this godforsaken country is like they're doing it. We're not being educated on, well, what's really going on. And by the way, you people know that half the ice is gone in the Arctic, and, you know, there's explanations about the mangled jet stream, the slowing of the Gulf Stream. I mean, there's explanations that can be explained to people. But, no, what do we get? Some sort of he-she shit. I mean, it's ridiculous. And this is their response to the real climate going crazy in front of our very eyes. This is how we're going to have to be told to deal with it by looking at
Is there any way, Sandra, of showing the American people how it's handled? For instance, this might actually be a beneficial little segment on Meet the Prestitutes, to show people how this is talked about in the civilized world.
If the civilized world is England, you know, they're also getting sold a bill of goods in the face of, you know, just calamitous sort of weeks upon weeks of storm after storm. Like, they've had one long hurricane since December, literally. And all we're hearing from the Cameron government is, we've been cutting flood funds since we got into power. And now there's no money, and councils are charging people for sandbags. Do I need to repeat that?
Charging people for sandbags. Well, right. I mean, what would Ayn Rand do?
Well, and so, and all of a sudden when Eden and the playfields of his schools were being flooded out, then they said money's no object. I mean, it's just stunning, looking at how that horrible, disgusting government is handling, something that only a state can respond to. And since they're turning everything over to their buddies, I mean, and that's for real, real over in England, what they're doing. They actually have privatized the mail. They're in the process of privatizing the NHS. They make people work for free. They make disabled people work to the point where they commit suicide. I can go on and on, but I'll stop. And they passed a lobby bill that if you're a union or an environmental group and you spend more than $500,000, you can be prosecuted. Now, I'm not advocating campaign, that you shouldn't have campaign finance, but this bill is a bunch of bullshit that they passed, because if you're in-house, you can spend as much as you want, i.e. the corporations and lobbies that are associated with the main parties. But if you're a public interest group, you have a limited amount of money you can spend, and then you cannot advocate. This is the way for the Cameron government to shut down dissent with the election coming up next year. So you want to see a police state in formation? Go to the UK. It's amazing. I follow it because I have friends there, and it's just kind of, I'm just stunned by the transformation of that country since the Cameron government come to power.
See what happens. They have they've completely dismantled everything that was good for the people of the UK, and what I mean, we see the stories periodically, Sandra, about a little bit of rioting breaking out here and there or demonstrating, but I guess when you're having to scrape up money to buy sandbags, you really don't have time to put feet in the street, do you?
Well, and if you do, the Metropolitan Police has requested water cannons for the first time ever in the UK. So why are they getting water cannons?
But doesn't this smell a little bit like new normal?
Well, it's a really frightening new normal for the people of the UK, because their whole public comment is sort of, I call it the new enclosure. I know we've been here before, but that's what's going on in England again, because they also have a law that they're working on that can literally put anyone in jail who protests out in the street. So if you're assembly in some way, I forget the exact name of the law, but it really does restrict individuals' movements. If you're not supposed to be in that area, then they can remove you. So, I mean, it's pretty scary what's going on there, and it's all in response to, or it's in tandem with austerity, because austerity is just another, it's almost like another way of just saying, selling off the commons, you know, to private hands. That's
sure.
Kind of what austerity is.
Liquidation.
Yeah. But, Anyway, yeah, but, you know, back to, you know, our situation here. I mean, I was wondering what the response would be to, like, the real existing climate calamity. And it's not very comforting, Bob. It's kind of disturbing because I don't want to see no debate between some idiot and a sincere but naive person of thought. That's not working for me. That's not developing policy. I don't know what that is.
No, and you know, once again, I think I would have liked, it's kind of like what Dr. John said earlier, Sandra, I kind of would have liked to have seen him send a shot across her bow. You know, she says, you're an actor. He says, well, you take $300,000 a year from the oil industry. You have no credibility.
Well, Michael Mann would have rolled that out. See, he got the wrong person. They could roll that fool out because he's been attacked so much. He's developed quite a good ability to respond to it, Michael Mann. But they're not going to have him up there, are they?
Apparently not. Or Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, or Hansen, or...
Oh, no. It will be a cold and frozen day in hell when Hansen shows up.
Right. Or some of these other... I don't know how you want to, you know, I don't know what you want to call it. I mean, I guess, they've been radicalized.
Well, this is Soviet, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, back when we were younger, we used to mock the Soviet Union for doing.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. Denial of reality.
No, but can we agree that, the guy who does Meet the Press is the most blatantly right-wing prick on TV?
Well, I don't know. I think Chris Wallace still has that pretty well nailed down, or are we just not counting Fox?
I'm not counting. Yeah, I don't, you know, I didn't pay attention to them, but maybe I guess I should. But no, I just mean he is unbelievable, that guy. I've never seen anything like him. I mean, I used to bitch about... Tim Russert.
Oh, no, Tim Russert's a journalist compared to David Gregory.
Yeah, I wish he was back, because David Gregory is just a tool, you know? He's just a right-wing tool. It's just...
And, I mean, you can tell how he adores the access.
Oh, no, it's just... No, he's just hideous, and I despise him. He's like... I really, really find him beyond despicable. And all these things, all these corporate outlets I find despicable, because... They're still trying to parade, although it is sort of, they are kind of diminishing because I think Congresswoman, whoever, we have to interrupt this because of Justin. I don't think that did them much service, like them interrupting that with the Justin Bieber stuff. You know, it's just, it's you know, but what we're looking.
But remember, didn't they threaten to get rid of Keith Olbermann years and years ago because he didn't want to talk about the death of Michael Jackson or something?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the nature of it since the '80s, which is why I'm just sort of flabbergasted, and I shouldn't be, but I am, at the prospect of Comcast and Time Warner. I mean, you know, it's just. That merger is mind-numbing.
Oh, well, what's going to be left? I mean, I love this. I love this argument being put forward that, well, Comcast doesn't operate in any cities where Time Warner does, and Time Warner doesn't operate in any cities where Comcast does, so no problem.
No.
I mean, that's like big problem monopoly.
Yeah, no. But I mean, I don't really think it's going to be a breeze for them to. To get through, especially if there's some sort of groundswell, a pushback. But just the idea that they feel okay about even putting that forward, and then you look at the sort of makeup of the regulating apparatus and how many people are ex-lawyers and ex-lobbyists and ex-this from Comcast who are now in government, you just shake your head and think, well, it's just Mussolini, you know, close the door and just good night, you know?
Yeah, and shred the... Well, look, I think from its very beginnings, cable was always a problem within the subset of broadcast regulation, because technically the FCC originally said they didn't have jurisdiction, right?
Mm.
And so consequently, that's why you can get words on cable that you can't hear on broadcast television. But ultimately, the whole net neutrality thing poses a tremendous risk. And I don't know if you've seen this thing or not, but I noticed over the weekend a couple of people pointing out a story from somebody saying, I've double-checked. The guy says, I've double-checked now, and Netflix is the only part of my Internet that is slowing down. So guess what? Because they want to offer their own movie service.
Right. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And so if you have something like Comcast, if that merger goes through, they're gobbling up, huge portions of the market, pulling a sort of Rockefeller Standard Oil where they control all parts of the production.
And is there any reason to think this will not go through?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, do you see the Obama administration digging in its heels and saying no, hell no?
Well, who knows? I mean, I really don't know. But there's a lot of there's other corporate entities that are not too keen on this. Netflix, of course, being one of them. But there's other. I'm sure there's other ones, other players too. So, I mean, we'll see. I don't know. But if it happens, it's just really going to be a really bad scene for consumers. That's all. It's going to be terrible. And, it's already going to be bridging. I can see a lot of court cases arising from it because, it's going to start running smack into, even if it is just a piece of paper, the First Amendment, because, it's like the content factor is going to be problematic. So we'll see. I don't really think it's going to be so, just a slam dunk, but I'm disturbed that it's even, gotten this far. So,
Well, I mean, somewhere along the way, you would think it would butt up against the Sherman Act, too, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that seems...
But that's why I asked the previous question that I did, Sandra, because when is the last time a Sherman Act claim has been filed?
I have no idea. I mean, I know that, what was that the last merger that went away? It was something with AT&T, I can't remember, but...
That was AT&T and, what was it, T-Mobile, or...
Yeah, so, I mean, not every one of them goes through. I mean, and there's a, this isn't sort of a open and shut case, but it is something that, we all should be concerned about and aware of because it's like I said, it's Standard Oil, 2014.
It feels a lot like it, and the new, and what we have to admit is that this is the confirmation that the new coin of the realm is information and communication, right? I mean, if John D. Rockefeller I was out there doing what and Gould and the rest of them, they'd all be in communications now.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but since what we're going to end up having, and this is, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm sorry to say this, but we'll have one giant media company, and then wanker outlets like that Glenn Greenwald paper and Ezra Klein. That's the choices we're going to have. I call them wanker outlets. There's that other guy, the gay guy, Dish Sullivan.
Andrew Sullivan.
You just have those sort of outlets plus Comcast. That's what the media landscape is going to look like.
Well, Jason just tweeted to me. He said, the right wing either owns or is buying most of the media once they own the Internet, and then what?
Yeah, then what? Then you're fucked.
I mean, we're running here this little itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny thing that has managed to stay alive for 10 years when a lot of others have gone by the wayside, and there's a lot for all of us to be proud in that. But what, you know, what happens if, I mean, if I get a bill saying, you know, if you really want your stream to get through, I mean, that sounds like a protection racket out of an old organized crime novel.
Yeah, it's just, that's all it's going to be. I mean, that's the only way you can compare it. I mean,
I'd hate it if anything happened to your little stream there, Bob. You know.
Yeah, no, on the other hand, you know, it's interesting the stuff that's going on. Is it Tennessee where they, you know, have this super fast bandwidth? Several other cities sort of have their own. And then you have Kansas that is actually passing a law to prevent cities from creating their own networks. I mean, it's just stunning when you see stuff like that go on. I mean, well, Kansas is just kind of, I don't know, it seems to be like it's just hell on earth with their anti-gay bill. You know about that bill.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the problem with that bill,
I mean, you know, we've been calling different states, you know, Stan for a long time. I'm wondering if we need to make a new exception for Kansas and call it Kansas, Kansanda.
Yeah, well, I don't think people, I mean, I'm assuming that bill is going to be challenged too, but I also think that, you know, gays beware, but I mean, women beware, because that can just roll into Sharia with the quickness. I don't know if you looked at that bill.
Yes.
That bill has the makings of some serious shit going down against females, straight up. So, and it's that horrible guy who's the governor there, Brownback, is that his name?
Oh, Brownback.
Brownback, I mean, he's from that whole family. You know, that whole group, them people who sponsor Let's Kill Off the African Gay bills that are all over Africa, the country. You know what I mean? All over that continent.
Africa, the country. You had to say that, didn't you?
That's one of my favorite blogs. I love that blog. It's Africa is a country, and now they have football is a country. It's all about, you know, African, well, worldwide soccer, but it focuses on the sort of foot soccer in Africa. So, but anyway. Yeah, I just think that's really funny because, you know, people on Twitter went after Jeffrey Sachs because he was comparing China to Africa. People were like, Mr. Sachs.
Dude, please.
Africa is not a country. Well, I mean, you know, I was really disappointed because I've been following Jeffrey Sachs' transformation from gutting the Soviet Union to someone who seems to be like, oh, my God, this system of infinite growth is fucked up. So I was a bit disappointed when he busted out with the comparing continents with countries. I'm like, you know, that's geography, you know, 101 if there's such thing.
Well, I'll probably get hate mail, but, you know, there's a certain element of this country where they all look alike to them.
Well, no, but he, you know, he knows better, though. That's why. I was just outrageous.
That's, you hope with him that that's a failure of proofreading.
Well, and I don't know what the hell it is. He's a development economist extraordinaire. So it's just kind of, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
I'm always amazed by, you know, at the end of the day, they're all just sort of white men. So,
God.
Oh, but yeah.
I know.
Then we also, I'm sorry.
No, please, go ahead.
Yeah, then we also have the, we can't seem to convict people for murder if they kill up black children in Florida.
And we got a fresh one, Sandra. We've got a fresh one. Do you know? You know about this one? Out of Arkansas.
But that's a black man. So didn't they charge him right away?
Yeah. But we're still gunning down teenagers that we don't necessarily like.
No. That's terrible. This is some 15-year-old girl who. Egg some dude's car, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's terrible. I was like, oh, my God, you know. It's too much. It's, I don't know. See, I just, you know, when I was growing up, we did so many little bad things around our neighborhood. You understand what I'm saying, Bob? You know,
yeah.
That's what you do. You're on your bike, you're doing naughty things. I've been there.
And now you get killed for it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, somebody might have called my mother or told my mother or something. and I get whatever accordingly at home.
Yeah, but let's do point out. Yeah, let's do point out here that the black guy who shot the child in Arkansas got handed first degree murder from jump. No questions asked.
Well, yeah, right.
But meanwhile, this dumbass jury, and really they have to be dumbasses. They deadlocked on first degree murder.
Well, I mean, it's just no. Basically, they said, yeah, well, he shot up attempted murder the other teenagers because they were getting away, they were leaving, so it was attempted murder. But I don't understand. What if Jordan was killed during the attempted murder part? I mean, how did they make that distinction?
Well, and there's a question here I haven't been able to sort out, and it has to do with the jury instructions. In most cases, but it's a prosecutorial decision and a bench decision, but in most jurisdictions, if you're charging first-degree murder, you can offer the jury the alternative of second degree.
Right.
You know, all the lesser includeds that fit.
Right.
And if you, as a prosecutor, just absolutely decide that you're going to plant your flag on the first degree hill, I always thought that was kind of stupid.
Well,
because juries don't appreciate having their hands tied.
Well, and also what's stupid is this notion that you cannot introduce race in these trials. That's also way up north at this point. It's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, I guess what, we're going to call that the Zimmerman rule now?
Well, which is why along with the trying to figure out if someone in someone's mind they were scared enough that justifies them using deadly force. You know, a jury, no. I mean, that law has to go. You know, it's sort of, I don't know. I don't want to say it's like you need to take on this sort of anti-lynching mentality to address those laws, but I'm about there because the victims of these laws keep being, you know, black people. So I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah, well, and see, that's another one of those language problems we run across, Sandra, is that people think lynching has to involve a rope.
Well, no, Clarence, you know.
Yeah, Clarence put paid to that, you know, it was the high-tech lynching. Yeah.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying. Anyway, I don't know. I was very, of course, disturbed by the outcome of that madness. And they said they're going to retry that asshole.
I hope.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got you get a mistrial, you get a second bite of the apple.
Well,
to be fair, you get a second bite of the apple as long as it's not prosecutorial misconduct, at least for the mistrial.
Well, as long as he's remanded in jail, he's not out, so he's back in jail, right?
Yeah, I think he was remanded just based on the other convictions.
On the convictions, okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's Florida, so. But the only other
they may have a parade for him tomorrow. It's Florida.
Oh, my God. The only other thing I want to mention, and then I'll hang up, is I don't know if you saw this. Did you see that dude from Texas, a sportcaster, do one a sort of editorial on that kid going into the NFL?
No.
He just...
You talking about Michael Sam?
Yeah, Michael Sam, but the broadcaster is the sportcaster.
Oh yeah, I did about you know why is this an issue? What's wrong with you people?
Right, and how he busted out. You know, if you kill somebody, you can go into the NFL. It was just really I was so surprised. You know, what can I say? I was really surprised, and then he brought up Audre Lorde. I was like, huh? You know.
Well, every now and then one sneaks through, Sandra.
Yeah, that shit was on. And, you know, I mean, I really sort of appreciate what the guy was saying. He wasn't coming across as, yeah, he just was different and hopeful. I just thought, well, that's, you know, good for him. Shit. And it was from Texas and the whole nine yards. I just thought that was really, although I do wonder about dude. I don't know. Shit, I'd be a bit fucking scared.
You know what? If you get drafted by the Dolphins, don't sign.
Oh, no, no. You know what? As someone was saying, they were saying it really depends on what team he gets on. You know, some teams would be better than others, obviously. I mean, I don't know which team that might be.
Ravens.
Seattle.
Yeah, not San Francisco, not Miami.
Right.
I'm guessing not Dallas.
Not New Orleans.
No, you didn't.
Because we already had somebody worried about him looking at
Oh, yeah, Jonathan Vilma.
As if. I'm just like, is your junk that tantalizing? I mean, it's just I'm just like.
Well, it's late in the program, but Sandra gets the toaster.
Well,
is your junk that tantalizing?
Listen, when I agree with Colin Cowherd, you know something must be wrong.
Oh no, that's when you go shower with bleach.
Yeah, I'm like, huh? Am I agreeing with this fool? But yeah, you know, he rolled out with some common sense shit too. So I just was like, well, it's you know, we've really come a long way, but we'll see. Because that one basketball player never got picked up.
Oh no,
you have to keep in mind.
No, with any luck, he gets a front office job or something.
Yeah, but this kid is a.
But the fact remains, Sandra. Going all the way back to that quote from the definitive Vince Lombardi biography. The NFL has had a closet for quite a while. Because if Vince Lombardi in 1969 with the Redskins, oops, I said it, with the Washington team, is calling in his assistants and saying, if one of you people makes life hard for this man, as long as he's playing football hard, you will be gone before your ass hits the floor.
Well,
and that's 1969.
Yeah, we know that. You know that winning negates everything. And the fact that that team kept that. Yeah, anyway, I don't know. I mean, I just think it depends on where the dude goes. But, yeah, I don't know. Good luck, I guess.
Yeah, no. Hey, Sandra, it's good hearing from you. You have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
All right, bye now. Time to roll on out of here. Thanks, everybody, for getting and for helping us with fundraising this evening. Thank you for the kind challenge. Dr. John, thank you to Ed, and thank you to Tony, and thanks go out to Asa, and I want to make sure that I get everyone included here. And thanks to Chris, Randy, we are a little bit out in front, so we only have to raise $75 tomorrow. That means an awful lot. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you. And here comes Rick Smith on the horn.